Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday morning. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Oh, are you also nervous interviewing another great before you?
But who do you have in mind?
I'm not sure.
Is Senator Schumer on the line? He's coming up in our conversation. That's why he's fresh on my mind. Mr. Honlein, before we begin our conversation about the events of this week, why not remind me where you're going to be spending the high holidays?
Well, the high holiday, Rosh Hashanah, I will be at the Tarrytown Doubletree Hilton with Rabbi Moshe Fuchs, as past years, but it's a new location, a beautiful place, and I'm looking forward to a meaningful and spiritual Rosh Hashanah.
Boy, how do you get a gig like that? I'm going to be at the New Springville Jewish Center. So knowing the two,
how do you get a gig like that?
I was just going to say, knowing the two of us, you're the jealous one. So I will be out there on Staten Island while you are enjoying the Yuntif, as you just described. All right, is it possible? And you know, Malcolm, I love starting with good news when humanly possible. Is it possible that the discovery this week of this water reservoir at the foot of Robinson's Arch could be from the first temple era?
Well, all the indications are that it, in fact, is from the first temple era. It's described variously as a cistern, as many other things, but it was clearly one of the sources of water, and it solves one of the mysteries. There's also references in Josephus to it. So this, again, further proof of the sources and of the description of what existed in Yerushalayim at the time and how sophisticated the systems were that existed to provide water, you know, to Jerusalem, which was and to be able to sustain it if they were assaulted.
And just to remind our listeners, especially those who may not be familiar with the timeline, we're talking about close to 3,000 years.
Right.
Which is unbelievable. And as you say, all of this always helps because you know how it is. The enemy always wants to change the facts on the ground. Sometimes, especially with expert opinion and the right publicity, it's hard to change hardcore evidence that's 3,000 years old.
Right. And for those who claim the temples didn't exist and that all of this is mythology, here you have, again, real proof. And, I mean, it assured first of all, a better understanding of the water supply, but assured the people who lived there at the time of another source and ample backup when it wasn't raining.
This is not going to be an isolated episode. I know there have been other episodes in terms of Second Temple era and even back to the First Temple, but you're assuming that now, as more and more exploration is done, news like this is going to become like, you know, every day we'll hear stuff like this, right?
But the news should not be every day. The reports may come, and they do come, and many of the things that they discover are not don't get the kind of notice that this did. But the it should never become commonplace, because each of these things is so important. Here you have this large rock-hewn water reserve from the time of the first base of Mikdash. We don't know what else will be relocated. This is at the foot of Robinson's Arch. This is also part of the Ir David excavations and the amazing things that they have found and the people at the tunnels found, and so many that people don't even report on a lot of the these amazing discoveries.
Yeah. It is incredible. All right, like I say, good to start with some good news. What did you think of the back and forth, the political football, or in this case, I guess it would be more accurate to say a political hot potato, the way it was going back and forth, about Jerusalem and God being mentioned or not being mentioned, and of course being included at the end in the platform of the Democratic Party? I mentioned Senator Schumer. It was shocking to me that he, as a quote-unquote Jewish political leader who's very close with the president, is the symbol of the Democratic Party in the year 2012, and his response was, it was just sort of left out.
Well, I think beyond the individuals, I think there's a very important fact that gets lost here. Number one, we want to see Jerusalem, Israel, all of these issues be bipartisan. We want Republicans, Democrats alike. We don't want to see these become debated as if it belongs to one side or the other. To be pro-Israel is to be pro-United States, and Republicans, Democrats alike should share it. On the issue of Jerusalem, it is the law of the land. In 1995, by overwhelming majorities, I think 90% in both houses, they declared Jerusalem, the United Jerusalem, as the capital of Israel, being recognized by the United States. And frankly, it was legislation which I played a very key role. It was led by Senator Moynihan, and Prime Minister Rabin came in. It was, in fact, the last thing he did visit here for the event we did in the Rotunda. I think it was the last public event of this kind in the Rotunda. And he said it was one of the great days of his life. We had this immense outpouring of members of the House and Senate and officials who came and spoke. The mayor of Jerusalem came at the time. It was Ehud Olmert. So this is the law of the land. And so recognition is only consistent with it. It's not breaking ground, because all of them keep saying, you know, it's also a final status issue. Everything's a final status issue. There were also other things that were in the last convention document, because remember that this is a document that comes out of the party apparatus. It's not something that necessarily emanates from the administration. But in this case, they said that the administration vetted it or was consulted. They also said that AIPAC was, and they completely denied that. Other people names were thrown in and have said they did not see this version, because one of the things that was in the last time that is not here is about the refugees, where it says that the refugees, Palestinian refugees, will be resettled in whatever the Palestinian entity will be.
That was in the platform of the Democratic Party?
Yep.
But what's it? There has
4 years ago, but this time, and there were other omissions, and it's only because in the contrast, it's not because the Republican Party platform necessarily includes all these things. It does talk about the security of Israel being vital and the national security interests of the United States. It does talk about defensible borders and does mention the Jewish state of Israel with Jerusalem as the capital. And says that all the final status and all the other things that they and puts the demands on the Arabs as to what is expected of them. So,
yeah,
you know, obviously people are going to compare and contrast. I don't know those who drafted it, if it was because it's done more or less anonymously, but certain names have come out, Robert Wexler, others,
right, but
being associated with it.
But even objectively, let's forget about partisan politics for a moment, even objectively, what was the strategy here? It was not, I'm sure you would say, it was probably not, as Schumer suggested, that it was just sort of left out or somebody, you know, happened to make a mistake. There must have been something going on that allowed for them to leave it out, get a reaction, and of course, if they had no choice based on the publicity to put it back in, okay, they'll put it back in. And they gave, you know, President Obama credit for that. He looked pretty good, by the way, you know, standing up in that way and saying it immediately has to be put back in. So what was the strategy here? Were they testing the waters? Were they trying to ruffle certain feathers?
Well, the admission of God would sort of say that, you know, they weren't picking their allies well. But look, I can't tell you because I wasn't part of the process. I've heard all the reports. I've spoken to people in the party and administration about it. We did immediately. There were a number of members, people like Steny Hoyer and Elliot Engel and others who really got into this process and tried to change it. And I know that Schumer weighed in it later in the process and to get this change reinstated. And as you said, it was ultimately the decision of the president saying that they wanted to. But, you know, what would give one basis to believe that this was is haphazard was the way that it was handled. I mean, this
right.
became...
Right.
And I think, frankly, the lasting image that many people will have in our community was the vote. And even if the vote was about God or was about the process,
right.
the fact is that you had people booing, and those on the ground told me that the atmosphere was so ugly.
Right, you could
comment
on the video. It looks that way. Yeah,
it does.
Yeah,
but many people may not have seen
right.
the video of Villagrosa having to go to three votes and
right.
then finally declaring a 2/3 majority, which I think many people were.
But you know, but it's funny because I remember the two of them were linked. And to be fair, there are a lot of people who don't like, as we know, and plenty of people in our community who don't like references to God in their party's political position or platform. So once the two were linked, I thought that was a little bit unfair to say, okay, those who are booing are for sure booing for Jerusalem?
Well, frankly, I want God on my side. So if we're going to have a vote,
no, I understand.
I want to
that.
Vote on God with us.
No, I understand that, and that would, of course, be that would be my recommendation as well. But you know how it is, especially with the Democratic Party, how sensitive it is when God and church and state and right. all this stuff. You know, so that was a little. You know, I thought that you know give them a little pass on that, but the whole thing was comical.
And also, the process. I mean, to have to get up, put it up on
right.
the screen,
right.
and then tell people to vote. You don't know who's in the room at that point. You don't have. Maybe the hardcore people who and key leadership because they're all
the right wing radio announcers are probably voting.
Sorry?
The right wing radio hosts are probably voting.
Which way? And the if you look at the pictures of the room, I mean it's huge. There are huge gaps, empty parts of the room. In that hall, people yelling sounds. You know, you can carry the certainly the image and the impression. But there were many thousands there right. at the time.
Okay, yeah.
And I think it's, you know, it's of concern. But again, the issue gets distorted.
Right.
And again, I don't want to see it as a partisan issue. What I think you'll see a lot of recriminations, and I think we're going to see some books that will ultimately tell us the real truth about how it, but it was not just a happenstance.
Right.
That's clear.
Okay, so agreed on all that. But and it may be my naivete, and this will be my final thing on this, but I'd like... You know, why, and maybe again, it may be just that, you know, I was much younger decades ago, so I didn't realize what was going on. But in 2012, why does it have to be that a Jewish government leader, somebody associated with the White House, somebody very close to the president, why can't they get up, and those who are known to defend Israel and care about Jerusalem and say in every speech how much they care about Jerusalem, why can't they just get up and express anger about this? Why can't they just get up and say, this is outrageous, it doesn't belong, things like this don't belong in our party, and now we have to, you know, respond appropriately. It seems like you can't get an honest comment anymore because everyone's afraid of, in this case, you know, insulting the president or doing something wrong in the papers.
Well, members of Congress certainly did speak up. There were people who spoke up very vociferously.
Democrats.
Democrats, yes. And people both at the convention and outside the convention gave interviews. People generally don't read the platform. And so when somebody finally reads it and notices the absence, and obviously it's the first part I would turn to and others would turn to, and it's, you know, it's two paragraphs. Look at the Republican. It's a, you know, it's the same. It's a very short insertion.
Right.
About the Middle East and about Israel, so you know. But it caught people's eye when this, of all issues, you know. Frankly, if they included Jerusalem, the other issues might not even have been noticed.
Right.
But not to say it, and to then say that they left it out because it's consistent with U.S. policy, meaning that because the administration's in power and you know the questions about Jerusalem, that compounded the problem.
Do you agree with the following statement? It's hard to believe that President Obama, even now, would get less than 70% of the Jewish vote in November.
No, I think he's below 70% by most polls.
Between 60 and 70?
Yes.
I don't know. For some reason, I keep thinking that the Jewish community of the United States is still going to give him 70% of the vote, but we'll find out soon. Who's right?
Listen, it's still a long time. You got the debates. I think the debates this time will play a big role. A lot will depend on what Mitt Romney is able to do to appeal to broader audiences. I think it'll depend a lot on the numbers that come out this morning and come out in a couple weeks on the jobs. I mean, because that still is the critical issue. Foreign policy is secondary in all of this.
Yeah, and they're anticipating that jobs report for August is going to be pretty bad. America's one and only Jewish Moments in the morning radio program, heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. We have you covered all week long. Now we have you covered over the weekend as well. jmnam.org, our online amazing presence, will feature Saturday Night Siegel with Avrami tomorrow night starting at 10 p.m. Eastern time on the stream. And then the big news of the week, of course, is that Matas Weingast will host a JM in the AM Sunday, starting this Sunday at 7 a.m. Eastern Time, live between 7 and 9 on the stream at jmtheam.org. Make sure to be tuned in from around the world. Information about the podcast of the weekly update, go to the news section of jmtheam.org. Sign up, have the weekly update delivered straight to your iTunes. Is it accurate to say that former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is now completely out of the Israeli political scene?
He's indicated as such, and that he didn't want the perks, and he said in the court that because there was a moral turpitude charge that was dropped, which would have prevented him from running, I think, for 7 years, but he's not going into it, and they dropped the charge. But he still has the Holy Land Foundation case coming up, so I don't think there's any return imminent anyway.
I didn't even realize there was a proposed restriction on him from re-entering. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and U.S. Ambassador Dan Shapiro did engage in a sharp, undiplomatic exchange last Friday over Netanyahu's frustration with the Obama administration's Iran policy. This according to a U.S. congressman in the meeting. Republican Congressman Mike Rogers from Michigan, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, told a Michigan radio station that the, quote, sharp exchange was, quote, unusual, to say the least. What happened there Friday? Why couldn't the ambassador and the prime minister get along?
Well, a diplomat's job is to get along. It's not the prime minister's job. But in this case, Dan Shapiro, who is a good friend and a good guy, and has been a very good ambassador, it seems that the prime minister made some comments about and was expressing his frustration, I guess, on the Iran issue. And the ambassador must have responded saying that, in fact, the administration policy was more aggressive. I don't know the words, but I'm telling you what I think the thrust of it was. Mm-hmm. And with Mike Rogers sitting there, and then it deteriorated into somewhat of an intensive exchange. Both sides afterwards played it down, but at the end of the ambassador himself said that the reports were silly, that it wasn't true. He told me that it wasn't true. The fact is that something did take place, and it's a reflection, I think, of the intensity of the moment and the concerns about, particularly about Iran.
So if it was a private meeting without a member of the House there, it's possible it would have gone differently.
You would never have known about it.
No, well, not just that, meaning that the ambassador may have been somewhat embarrassed that a member of the U.S. government sitting there as he's getting yelled at by the prime minister.
Well, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee.
Right.
No, but also he may not have felt the need to try to defend the position.
Good point.
Without the chairman sitting there.
Right, good point. Is it true or not, speaking of Iran, that in the middle of 2013, which is just a few months away, there are going to be new elections for president of Iran?
They are, yes. These are scheduled. These are long scheduled, and why I said that Ahmadinejad will be off the scene in a few months.
Not legal for him to run again?
No.
And that's it?
And Khamenei would not let him run again. The divisions there are very deep. And that's why I say we should not talk about Ahmadinejad,
right,
and nor demonstrate against Ahmadinejad, because he's not important. It's Khamenei. Because people will say, once Ahmadinejad is off the scene, oh, we got a new president, you got to give him a chance, you got to work, we got to see. It's no difference. Because it's Khamenei that's calling the shots. The regime will be, policy will stay the same. If they put a new face on it, it's irrelevant. And that is really important for people who always press about certain things to understand that for us to focus on Ahmadinejad will in a few months prove counterproductive.
But my question is, just like we, in a positive manner, hopefully, often look at transitions in the U.S. and start thinking of who might do what before or after that specific date, do we now have to worry that a madman is about to leave office, relatively speaking, and God forbid he may decide to do one thing or another to leave his mark?
No, because he will not make the decision, ultimately, for what happens. He can raise the rhetoric, he can try to go out and flourish, but he's not the one who has the finger on the trigger.
And Malcolm, when you make public statements about fearing chemical weapons as much as, or even more possibly, than the nuclear capabilities in Iran, you're referring to chemical weapons in Iran or in Syria or both?
In Syria right now, and the danger of it falling into Iranian and Hezbollah hands. And the story is very important, because this is not a hypothetical, this is not a WMD story, this is existing stockpiles. We know of at least 6 bunkers where they have huge amounts, and another 14 facilities. So it's more than 20 facilities that they acknowledge. We believe it could be as many as 50 facilities. And the United States has been aggressive in looking and trying to monitor this, intelligence units, working with some of the neighboring countries. I think it's safe to say Jordan, others are very interested. Israel is certainly very concerned about this and has been urging attention to it for a long time, as we've talked about it on the show for a long time, because people just don't take this stuff seriously. They don't believe it anymore. And Syria probably has the biggest stockpiles of chemical and biological in the world. And the question of what would happen to them, and it's not just if the regime falls, what happens if all of a sudden more soldiers defect, some of those guarding some of these facilities, when you have 20 sites like this? And we know that Assad has beefed up the security around it, but what if that security is Hezbollah guys? What if it's, IRGC, Iranian soldiers who are inside Syria, and if they are given the charge for these facilities, so the collapse of the government, and even if it's in several of the provinces, certainly has got to raise the concern and the preparations for how you secure the sites should the need arise.
Oh boy, the report that 100,000 people left Syria in the month of August, is that possible or exaggerated?
103,000.
It could be that large?
Yep. The latest report from this is the doubles the total from the last year and a half, almost, according to the UN refugee agencies. And so far, I think altogether, like 235,000 refugees who are registered. It doesn't mean all of those who fled the country to other places. These are people who are in Turkey, Jordan. I think Jordan has 77,000, Lebanon 60, and Iraq has probably around 20,000. So this is only the number that we know. The number, in fact, probably is much higher of those who have fled Syria.
And unbelievable. What do you make of this Reuters report that there have been secret negotiations between American officials and Iran on the subject of trying to keep Israel militarily out of Iran?
Look, there have been a number of these kind of reports. There was even a report that Ban Ki-moon had somebody with him who was carrying messages, and there is no evidence that this is true. The report on Reuters was particularly troubling because it had the specificity to say that the message was that if you don't hit American targets, i.e. Iran, if you don't hit American targets, we will stay out of it.
Right.
But the report does not seem to be substantiated in any way. And right now we have so many reports coming out, and there are legitimate stories, the Dempsey stories, the Panetta's visit, the story about the ambassador, so that everything then is assumed to be true when it in fact isn't, and you can start rumors about things that are accepted and become reality.
It just seems like a silly card to play. You're going to trust the Iranians to keep their end of the bargain of not hitting your targets?
So I think that one can dismiss the story. The story about the U.S. and Turkey working together on Syria and perhaps a plan, I think, is legitimate. And I think the story I told you last week about the four-party, the Egypt, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Iran,
right,
I think will have increasing legs in the future.
Has Egypt gone ahead and increased its tank withdrawal from the Sinai?
Egypt did withdraw more tanks from the Sinai and replaced them with armored vehicles. So for his own constituency, he can say, that he just did it for tactical reasons. He gained status by having, quote, confronted the Zionist regime and put the tanks in. He can show Israel that he was cooperative by removing the tanks. The situation in Gaza hasn't gotten better. They're not really using the tanks to quell terrorism and to counter it. So I don't think that, we've lost much by it.
Only the Israelis could be depended on, right? The one from yesterday was actually the Beit Hanun, which they squelched. There was evidence of that they were going to plant bombs, right?
Right. Yeah. And for him, remember, for him, the big issue right now is his economy, and he's looking for a huge amount of debt relief from the United States, about $1 billion of the 3.2 they owe, plus additional assistance. And he knows very well that Congress was not going to approve that if he kept those tanks there and violated the agreement.
Is that only a congressional decision, or it's White House as well?
No, it's both. But I think you need congressional approval on a $1 billion allocation, and the so he has to balance a lot of concerns. And I'll tell you an interesting thing about the visit that he paid to Tehran last week in this regard.
Right.
By the way, there's a group of American businessmen leaving today to Iran, organized by the U.S. government, to Egypt, to promote business and to see what they can do. And in the meantime, he's extending the Muslim Brotherhood control.
Right.
They appointed 10 new provisional governors yesterday, 4 of them for Muslim Brotherhood directly, and 3 generals that he approved. They took over the Human Rights Body. They took over the Media Council after he appointed a Muslim Brotherhood guy as the Minister for Communication. So slowly but surely, he's putting his people into every position. But what I wanted to point out was the speech that Morsi gave in Iran. Now that we get to see the text, and you know that it was distorted by the Iranians, and in the broadcast, they took his criticism of Syria and turned it around to say that he supports Syria, and that the criticisms were directed at Bahrain, not at Syria, which is, as you know, an ally of Saudi Arabia. And he said that there's a crisis in Syria and we must support the ruling regime, when he called for the ruling regime to be removed.
Right, and I think he said Assad by name, didn't he?
He set aside by name.
Yeah.
Exactly. But if you look at the rest of the speech, there are a couple of points. I won't go through the whole thing. Number one, he mentioned Nasser in a very positive way.
Wow.
And he knows that the Muslim Brotherhood and Nasser had tremendous animosity. So why did he do that? He also made reference to the caliphs, to the first Islamic caliphs. And these are people hated by Shiites, which is Iran. And then he attacked Assad by name, which he knows Iran backs.
Right.
The Nasser reference was for the young revolutionaries and leftists in Egypt. It was a play to them. He also used the Quranic quote, which was used by Sheikh Rahman, you know, the little blind sheikh, to justify terrorism. The same quote, which is really considered to be a very aggressive one. And that he used in his speech to the Egyptian army. But you will see several references here where he's playing off everybody. He goes to Tehran to force Saudi Arabia to say, well, we better, you know, pay attention to him. He insults the U.S., but at the same time it takes on Iran because he's trying to assert, I think, Egypt's role, the traditional role. He is trying to leverage the West and leverage even his neighbors, Saudi Arabia and others, in order to say, you better buy me off if you don't want me to go in the way of Iran.
I was chuckling when you talked about him trying to ingratiate the a youthful left, because I guess we've reached a point in history where now Nasser's the moderate. Now he's being used as the symbol for them.
Well, that this was the pan-Arabic, you know, the
right.
Days of glory, that kind of stuff. And he was a leftist. He was secular also.
Right. Just when
it becomes a symbol for
But just when we think of Nasser, we think of aggressiveness and the enemy, frankly.
I actually thought you were going to be broadcasting from Tehran, where you have the Festival of Islamic Resistance going on with Hezbollah and Hamas, Islamic Jihad.
Could we get a lineup of good guests with that?
Very good.
Really?
Absolutely.
I didn't realize you had so many connections there. the Security Cabinet meeting did not go well. And I'm referring to the aftermath of the Security Cabinet meeting, not the meeting itself. Prime Minister Netanyahu, and I've brought this topic up to you a million times, Prime Minister Netanyahu is frustrated by the fact that there are too many leaks when these meetings take place. Is there a specific person, by the way, that he's targeting right now, or he ends the meeting abruptly because of the general problem of all these leaks taking place?
He probably meant most of them, but the when I saw him, he was frustrated with the conduct of some of the ministers.
And, it's
you know,
crazy.
Everybody leaks everything.
It's
there.
Terrible.
And it becomes impossible that even in the Security Cabinet, so he's talking about polygraph testing people.
Are you serious?
It would be a bad idea. The problem is, I don't know if any of them could pass one.
Is he serious about that? It's a joke.
No, I think he's serious. I don't know if legally he can implement
it.
Wow. And as I said, you know, I don't know if you put any group of politicians to the polygraph that any of them could pass it.
Maybe they're experts at getting by it.
You know, how to beat the system.
Unbelievable.
By the way, you know, you saw that this report that Israel is the most attacked country on cyber attacks of any, that there are 1,000 attacks every minute of every day of every week.
And I'm proud our website not responsible for one of them, even.
So far, that is true.
except when I yell about the leaks of the Israeli government.
Yeah, well, we heard there's some leaks at JMNA.
It's crazy. And by the way, your strategy on places like Migron, nobody's listening to you. Remember what you said a few weeks back? You said especially, you know, and we're just, you know, 7 years now removed from the Gaza a tragedy and disaster. There's got to be a better way to handle this. And, of course, this week, in a more quiet fashion, I guess we could say, thank God, we don't want people killed in this process. But Migron was evacuated. And as you've said, once the facts are on the ground or once there's a desire by a group of people to help, you know, build Israel, there's probably a different strategy the government should be using.
I think this time, actually, they have to be credited for a better approach, for having negotiated and working it out.
That's true. Negotiate.
So this one went much better than some in the past, but then you have outsiders who come in and stage it and make people then think it was the people of Migron. It was not. By the way, there was one other thing I forgot to say before when we were talking about Iran, and this is very important for American citizens to know. In Nicaragua, they've uncovered a huge base, a training base run by Iran and Hezbollah. Now, you know how long I've talked about growing influence through Venezuela, Honduras, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Ecuador, etc. So now they uncover this base in Nicaragua near the Honduras border where Iran and Hezbollah are training people for retaliatory strikes against the United States. And you have there a confluence of organized crime, the drug cartels, the weapon smugglers, all who come to this place. It becomes then a center for these activities, and it compounds the story. I told you last week about Ecuador building this infrastructure of their banks to help Iran bypass the sanctions. You know, when people hear the stories that we've talked about for maybe 10 years about the cigarette smuggling, how it's used to raise money for Hamas, Hezbollah, etc., in the United States, from Canada, from Mexico, but more so the infrastructure being built in South America for these things, that you have the link of narco-terrorism to the terrorism networks, how Hezbollah has bases that were uncovered throughout Mexico, but they are tied in also with they take over the business of the legitimate cigarette distribution, tobacco distribution, and members of the industry are finally waking up and really doing things about it because they've begun to understand this harms them, it destroys their business, it destroys the public health, you know, efforts, and also there are no controls over the contents of these cigarettes, but it yields, Nahum, hundreds of millions of dollars. This is not petty crime. Hundreds of millions of dollars.
Which goes to fund
terrorism. Exactly. Hamas, Hezbollah, and groups like that.
By the way, going back as well, because I wanted to ask you this earlier. So the aid that we still, the $1.2 billion you mentioned to Egypt, right? So what is that? The category of regular economic aid or military aid, or what do we call that?
It's actually a very good question. Because it's something that's being discussed now, what they're going to call it. There is money that was held up when Egypt arrested those human rights workers, and there was aid that had not been paid out because of the revolution in Egypt. So there's talk of taking it from that the residual money there and residual money for Afghanistan that was not paid out. So, you know, you wouldn't have a budgetary implication. It would be saying that it came from previous commitments.
But the reason I ask is because, and there are some listeners who are actively, you know, writing to the White House, either by computer or by regular mail still at this point. Is it proper to express dissatisfaction that Egypt's getting a penny from us at this point or not?
Well, the key here is that it has to be made conditional on performance and what Morsi does. I think Morsi is a very clever guy. I think he's doing, as I said many times, what Erdogan did. I think that you will see over time that they're, one, consolidating their hold, two, that they will play a more aggressive role internationally. This is the strategy of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is not Morsi's strategy. This is the plan and design that they came up with and that he is in charge of implementing, from the fact that they said they wouldn't run a presidential candidate to having the presidential candidacy, come from the Muslim Brotherhood, the victor, the parliament under Muslim Brotherhood control, now the army being eliminated as a challenge.
Right.
So this is where the United States has to use aid and other things as leverage. Now, could other countries, Saudi Arabia, et cetera, make it up? But the fact is that when Morsi went to visit, thought he was coming back with a big pot of gold, he came back with zero. Now the Saudi Arabia may leverage it because they hate the Muslim Brotherhood also. And I think we have to use whatever money we give. We have to have clear understandings. And the United States did press them about removing the tanks, et cetera. But I think, you know, this guy can't be continue to be described as the democratically elected leader. This guy is moving more into the dictatorship mold, or certainly the mold of the Muslim Brotherhood dictatorship. And you see how he exercises control. That's why it's so important that when you watch who he appoints to what positions, he takes the key positions yep. that will enable him to control long-term the government.
Yeah, and if you're looking for, you know, it's, that money has to be distributed and, you know, only when used properly, so to speak. The U.S. does not have a good track record in that area. So I don't think
we generally are, because we're good people and we, you know, we want to help, we don't look to leverage our aid. Russia, you know, uses every dollar and everything to leverage whatever it gets and however it spends its money for its own purposes, regardless of whether sometimes it's stupid decisions like what they've done with Iran. And look, you know, the Russians, by the way, came out and warned Israel against a strike on Iran mm-hmm. This week. At the same time, the Russians also can't look without trepidation at the things that are happening, because it spills back to Chechnya, it spills back to the Muslim areas under their control, and they have a huge Muslim minority, and they see the naval exercises, they see some of the other things that are going on by the United States, and that for them is also a matter of concern, because they don't want to see the U.S. gaining influence in the region. So they have their own agendas, and as you know, Putin becomes very single-minded. The fact is that Iran's oil revenues are down, that Russia continues to fight against any intervention in Syria, and has they and China have warned again about Security Council measures during the upcoming session.
Yeah, they've really kept Assad alive, way, way, way behind schedule, but I just got to toss this in, especially this time of year, a time of introspection. It's and of course, you know, our role when it comes to immigration in the United States is always a very big topic, because obviously the United States has been amazing when it comes to the history of immigration, has generally been amazing. I know there are exceptions when it comes to being a secure homeland for Jews who've come from around the world. Israel now faces this problem in terms of desperate African immigrants who just want freedom and want to come to a country like Israel. It must be a real dilemma, moral dilemma, and obviously economic and otherwise type of dilemma when the Israeli administration faces this type of problem.
It's a huge dilemma, and people who think that these decisions are taken lightly, because remember, it has an immense security component, certainly economic component, it has social implications about how do you integrate. It's a small country, and when you have tens of thousands of people coming, it used to be more than 2,000 a month. Now the existence of the fence and more careful control has reduced the numbers greatly. The UN has called on them to allow in the people who are on the Egyptian-Israeli border. A country has a right and a need to protect its borders, to have an orderly immigration process. And there is an endless reservoir of people escaping economic conditions, some political persecution perhaps, but there has to be some standard. When Sudanese people in South Sudan were trying to escape because they were clearly refugees, they were accepted by Israel.
Yep.
And now that the South Sudan is recreated, they're saying that they should be going back. And, you know, you don't see the pressure on why doesn't Egypt absorb them, why doesn't others absorb these populations. It always comes down to the demands on Israel, and because you have people within Israel who have become advocates for them, as well as people, especially in the Tel Aviv area, who are generally strong on these things. Once it started impacting the quality of their lives, they become much more strong, outspoken. But I will tell you something. You know, the PA ought to be asked to take in some of these people. You saw the report that they're spending $4.5 million a month to give subsidies to all the terrorists in prisons, in Israeli prisons, and $6.5 million a month to the families of suicide bombers.
And the Israeli prison authorities can't stop that?
No, they pay. They don't pay the money directly to prisoners.
Straight to the families.
Families, they can give it to others. But here you're talking about $11 million a month just on this. And this is Fatah, Hamas, and even Israeli Arabs who were convicted of security crimes get these stipends, and some as much as $3,000 a month.
Unbelievable.
And so when they come and they beg and they say all the problems, you know, how much they need and the money, remind them of this.
Our final discussion of the year next week. Malcolm, thanks very much. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Thank you. There he is, Malcolm Hohenlein, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.